TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. The U.S. Government's Role in the Murder of Martin Luther King. A one-hour lecture by John Judge. John Judge is an acclaimed researcher and lecturer. He is co-founder of the Committee for Open Archives and the Coalition on Political Assassinations, and one of the foremost experts on government surveillance and secret operations. He helped draft legislation that led to the declassification of government documents on the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
We passed an act in 1992 following the Oliver Stone film JFK, which ended with the thing saying that the documents were still locked up, which meant that thousands of letters and calls went to Congress saying, why don't you release these documents on JFK? Since there had always been a vast majority of people in the country didn't believe the Warren Commission, believed that there was a conspiracy in the John F. Kennedy case, and so they wanted the records released. And that led to us being able to push through a law that for the first time had an impact.
In part one of this program, John Judge gave a vivid account of just how much of our collective history is buried in secret archives. He quoted the author, Martin Schotz, who said that we are allowed to believe everything but know nothing. John Judge also explained how the events of 9/11 are being used by the Bush administration to classify and reclassify more material and for longer than any U.S. government before. John Judge is currently working on legislation to declassify government documents on the assassination of Martin Luther King. This legislation has been introduced into the House by Cynthia McKinney and the Senate by John Kerry, and is based on the legislation that led to the release of documents on the murder of John F. Kennedy. Here is an account of the major unanswered questions on the King assassination that need to be addressed so we can rewrite the post-JFK and MLK history. Here is John Judge.
I believe that James Earl Ray, though he was forced into a guilty plea, did not kill Dr. King. I believe that based on exhaustive research that I did, including going down to Memphis. I've seen the crime scene, which has now been destroyed. The National Civil Rights Museum has reverse graded the area next to Jim's Grill where the actual assassin stood. So to stand where the real killer stood across from the balcony in the bushes, you'd have to get a cherry picker and be up in the air. There's no way that anyone could have killed Dr. King from the rooming house window. I went and stood in that tub in 1972. I opened the window, and either in order to aim a rifle far enough to the right to get where King was, you would have had to poke a wall, hole in the wall with your left elbow, or you would have had to lean out the window and try to shoot him, which gives you no stability for the shot. In addition to that, the closest eyewitness, besides those below that are watching, the one up on the balcony level, is a photographer and filmmaker, documentarian named Joseph Lowy, who was traveling with King on the strike and taking pictures from South Africa. Turned out that he was under the employ of the CIA. But he was standing out on the balcony when King was killed, and he said that King was lifted off his feet and spun to his right. If the shot is coming from up there, I'm going to be spun to my left and knocked down off of my feet. So the reaction is exactly the opposite. It's coming from across the street. And when you see these people standing and pointing in the photograph with some of King's aides, if you look at the actual angle of the motel, they are not pointing to the rooming house. The police didn't go into the rooming house for over an hour. Some of the people saw someone get up in the bushes, dismantle a rifle, run down the side of the hill, get on a motorcycle, and leave from the area. Jim Earl Ray was not in the rooming house at the time. He was changing a tire. He came back around, saw a bunch of police, and kept going in his Mustang. But Ray was allowed to escape from prison, arranged escapes. He was set up as a patsy and pushed into the position. He had this character, Raoul, is all that he knew him by, that he met in Canada. He was trying to get a passport out of the country, so Raoul was using him as a mule to carry things across different borders. He took him to Memphis, and he ordered him to buy the gun. I talked to the guy at the rifle store that sold James Earl Ray the gun, and he said the only person that ever came in that knew less about guns than James Earl Ray was the House Select Committee investigator that came in the 70s to ask about it. Okay. Ray was no marksman, he was no expert, but in addition to that, there was a trial before the civil trial, because Dr. Pepper was also the attorney for James Earl Ray in his last attempt at a legal appeal of his case. And he was never allowed to really try his stuff in court, but Pepper came up with a clever interpretation of the laws that said, if mostly based on DNA, but if new scientific methods made it possible to revisit a case and look at the evidence under new scientific capabilities, that you could then open an appeal on the case and at least hear that aspect. So he did that with the rifle. And Judge Joe Brown, who was an independently elected judge in Memphis, a former Black Panther, an African American, Yale educated, and a ballistic expert, sat on the trial as the judge. He allowed the scientific evidence. He had the weapon tested, and in the first test, it showed differences in the effect of the rifling on the bullet from the bullet that they had evidence had gone into Dr. King. So Dr. King's bullet didn't match. So the press, of course, said, it's inconclusive. Well, if you're on a murder trial and it's inconclusive whether the bullet came from your gun, you are acquitted, you're exonerated. I mean, that's what ballistics and forensics are for. But the press tried to make it seem like it's all confused, you can't determine. There was one more test that Judge Brown wanted to do, but before he could do it, the state Supreme Court of Tennessee stepped in and removed him from the case for being biased in Ray's favor. Then Ray wanted to continue. They were going to appoint another judge, but Ray was sick from a liver disease he got from being stabbed once in the prison, and had a blood disease and needed a new liver. Pepper found a place to replace the liver in a civilian hospital. The state authorities would not allow Ray to leave the prison, and effectively a death sentence. And so he died without the case being taken to court. Then the only other option was the civil trial by the King family to try to get the actual facts out. And Pepper's two books, Orders to Kill and Act of State, outline his investigation of that, but it goes beyond these small actors to a much larger network. And Pepper also develops evidence that there was a backup sniper team on top of one of the water towers at the railroad building down the street in Memphis with King directly in their sights. The documents that I got loose, not only I filed based in part on Operation Phoenix and some reports in the Memphis papers about the military surveillance of Dr. King, I filed a Freedom of Information Act request, and then it became a trial, a court suit, because they wouldn't honor it. First, they told us they had nothing. For the last 2 months of King's life, what did Army intelligence have on Dr. King? They came back and said they had nothing on Dr. King. We said, this is Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. You know, you never heard of this fellow? And they said, no, we don't have a thing. If we had anything, it would have been destroyed. So we went to court. We tried to show how they didn't look at their filing system properly. And the judge ruled in their favor. But then after all that, they said, oh, we do have one document that we sent over to the National Archives as part of a larger collection on the civil rights era. And it's 30 pages. And come down to the archive tomorrow and you can get it. This is a 30-page after-action report. An after-action report is a summary. It's not the raw data. And it talks about Operation Lantern Spike, which was supposedly an anti-riot unit under Garden Plot, which was a broader military counterinsurgency plan that included detention centers and martial law. They had it out in California as well, the early inceptions of it under Reagan, Meese, and Gefreda. Gefreda became an early head of FEMA. Mr. Louis Gefreda, he had worked at the Army War College, and he had developed a plan for for taking all blacks in the United States and putting them in detention centers in a time of emergency. And actually studied, this was his thesis, was how he could round up all the blacks in the United States. So he came into FEMA. FEMA and the DOD were working on readiness exercise plans through the 80s on what to do in national emergencies, how to detain people, and he presided over some of that. In fact, one of his deputies is currently in the post 9/11 planning for martial law and other sorts of things. So this mentality continues unbroken to this day, but post 9/11, Now military spying has started up again. Ashcroft told the FBI, basically, don't worry about those provisions. Go back to looking at groups that haven't done anything illegal. Spying the church is spying the political activities. Data mining and databases is more advanced. The NSA, prior to 9/11, start spying on larger numbers of people. Basically, the gate is open. But Lantern Spike was spying very closely on Dr. King, looking at what was in his garbage, planting bugs in the room. Knew what his plans were for travel. This was tight surveillance. At the same time, under the JFK Act, we got loose documents that showed that the FBI, under RIBAT, which was an anti-communist program, were spying on him, but also COINTELPRO was active on it. And then we got a third document that shows that the CIA, Operation Chaos, which was a similar anti-movement, anti-cultural program under the CIA, which had its own documents about dangerous black leadership in the country, was spying on him very tightly, right up to the day of his death. In other words, all three of those are spying on him actively. And we said, if you saved an after-action report because it had historical significance, you didn't destroy it, then don't the raw data that led to the summary have more historical significance? Where are they? And they say, oh, well, that was destroyed. Nobody has anything. So we want to get a situation where the agencies aren't making those decisions any longer, where we have a way to go in and force them to turn over the bulk of their documents and then to start to make a decision in a more open way. We've put in provisions that we would have a Citizens Advisory Council and committee for the board that will be appointed for this act that will include the King family. We've made provisions for a second depository, perhaps the King Center or the King Center Project. We've gotten support from former members of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, Bob Edgar and Walter Fauntroy. We've gotten public support from civil rights leaders. We're about to get the King Center, I think, and the SCLC to come on board. We have other government openness and civil rights organizations that are going to support the bill, but it does need additional congressional co-sponsors and public pressure to get it moving. I based a second bill on the Martin Luther King Act, which is for all the files on the life and death of Tupac Shakur, because he similarly was a target of this surveillance throughout his life. His family includes his mother and father, Effendi Shakur, and his father, who were part of the Panther 21 trial. Black Panthers that were set up on a phony charge after being penetrated by an agent of BOSS, the security system in New York, which is the same agency that penetrated the security of Malcolm X when he was assassinated at the ballroom, the Audubon in New York. And BOSS set up a situation where they would try to get these guys involved in a plot to blow, I think it was to blow up the Statue of Liberty. And then they brought these phony charges against them based on their own provocateur activity. His aunt, Asada Shakur, was broken out of prison by the Weather Underground and lives in Cuba now. His stepfather and sort of mentor, Mutulu Shakur, was framed on the Brinks robbery and is still in prison to this day. So if you don't think they were looking at that family, you don't understand how COINTELPRO works. And they were also looking at Tupac as he rose to national prominence. So he began to bring politics that he had learned from his family into his music and learned from his life experiences, and was a powerful voice. And one of the things I organized for Cynthia McKinney in September were panels at the Congressional Black Caucus called Countering Culture, which was about the attacks on political musicians all through the period, from the 40s forward, the attacks on Paul Robeson. And we had his son speak, who believes that he was given drugs that caused him to commit suicide by the government. Harry Belafonte, alive today, and just stood up with Cynthia McKinney recently, who was pilloried and called a communist and kept. But many others. There's a good documentary film, if you can get on DVD, called Scandalize My Name, narrated by Morgan Freeman, that talks about this whole history of the actors, the political. So it's not only the predominant culture countering any alternative culture, it's also a destruction of the cultural modes. And this is a history that you can track back probably through all of human history, but very specifically, I found evidence in my work on the rise of fascism in Nazi Germany that in the period from 1928 to 1932, there were 400 unsolved political murders. The Weimar Republic said they knew they were political. They said they couldn't understand who had done them, and they involved musicians, artists, labor leaders, activists, progressives. When people say to me, "Aren't you glad that Saddam Hussein is no longer in power?" my response is, yes, and I'd be even gladder if the CIA hadn't put him in power by giving him the names of 400 activists, democratic forces, and others to kill in his country to put the Ba'ath Party in power in the first place, and then armed him, including with weapons of mass destruction, to go after Iran. I can't be too happy about putting in 80 dictators and taking out two. There's something else going on. But this is a pattern that I think has existed in this country and up to the current day, and we did the hip-hop generation as well, and the murders of Biggie Small and Tupac Shakur, and questions around the role of the Ramparts Division, the LAPD, and the fact that we've got government documents showing again that until the day of Tupac's death and in the hour of his death, he was under government surveillance, the documents of which have never come forward. And he has, I would say, arguably to a current generation, as much impact as Dr. King had. He may not have the same historical legacy eventually, but as much impact in terms of the minds of the youth, and especially in the communities of color. So I think it's important that we at least try to establish a principle to get back to our own history. So we have a second gunman. We have Ray not shooting the gun, the rifle that's said to be the murder weapon, not the murder weapon. This is also a constant pattern through the political assassinations I studied. Patsies are set up, but when Ray gets to prison, the money deal for his lawyer, Percy Foreman, is based on a book deal with William Bradford Huey, who had just gotten finished writing something about the murder of Emmett Till. After Emmett Till's killers were exonerated by the courts, he paid them several thousand dollars to tell how they killed him in Life magazine, and then he becomes the chronicler of James O. Ray, who allegedly kills Dr. King. And Bradford Huey's book, his condition was that the book had to be an exclusive story. Therefore, Ray had to keep his mouth shut at the trial. Then Foreman shows up at the in order for the book to sell, and then the proceeds in the book to pay Foreman's salary. Foreman shows up at the last minute and tells Ray, "I'm tired. I didn't have any time to prepare a defense. You better plead guilty." And Ray understood that he'd been sold out. Many people say he confessed to the killing. He did not. He did plead guilty because he thought that Foreman told him, "Otherwise, you're going to go to the chair." And then, in addition to that, Foreman illegally gave $500 to Jerry Ray, the brother, to pay for the lawyer for the appeal. And Ray immediately, within 3 days after his conviction, filed for an appeal of his case with Judge Battle, who was, under Memphis law and Tennessee law, the only judge that could hear the case and take an immediate appeal. And Judge Battle was reading Ray's appeal on his desk when he fell dead of a heart attack and stopped the first appeal. A later judge, Miller, a progressive judge, stair-step integration decision in Cincinnati on the Sixth Circuit that heard some later appeals by Ray and backed Ray up and asked the right questions. In a second appeal, it was remanded to the local court and then brought back up for a final appeal to the Sixth Circuit. And Judge Miller was sitting, and I was anxious to see how it would be decided. And it came out that it was 3-0 on the legal panel against Ray. And I found that surprising because Miller had also been the judge that charged Hoffa with jury tampering, Jimmy Hoffa, and was an independent judge. And so I called the clerk of courts and asked him to send me the clerk slip. And then when I got the clerk slip, there was also an article in the Cincinnati Inquirer that said that Judge Miller had gone out to lunch with the other justices, come back into an emergency session, and died of a heart attack in the session. And then it said it had the list of the judges who had decided against Ray with an asterisk next to Judge Miller's name, and then the asterisk underneath said that his decision had been recorded posthumously by the other justices. Sit the dead man up and raise his hand. There were other strange deaths around Dr. King. A.D. King, the brother, was found drowned in a swimming pool, fully dressed in a suit at the back of the family home. He was one of the few witnesses also at the morgue. The mother of Dr. King was shot to death in the church in Atlanta, and I did a good deal of work on the person that did the shooting, Marcus Wayne Chennault. He told the SCLC from prison that he was part of a group called the Troop or the Truth that were out to kill black leaders across the United States and that they had been given lists. He had a mentor named David Hill who had taught him the gun running stuff, and David Hill had also a connection to Field Marshal Sin Kay of the SLA, who was himself a police agent. David Hill also went to Guyana and formed a group of black people in the jungles of Guyana about 10 miles from the Jonestown site, and they were allowed in to take the guns and the shoes and the valuables from the dead in Jonestown afterwards. And they were run by the government there, which had been put into power by the CIA. And this guy has all the earmarks, Marcus Wayne Chennault, of a programmed assassin, because one of the capabilities that they studied from World War II forward was how you could not only erase memory on people and control their minds, but how you could program people to carry out assassinations under mental control and under orders. And they found examples of these programmed assassins. One tried to kill Marcos in the Philippines, and Chennault comes out grinning, a gun in each hand, and says, he's smiling, and he says, "I did what I had to do." So, you know, I don't know who this guy is, but the effect is the mother is killed brutally in the church, and there were other deaths that I tracked, deaths of witnesses. One of the key witnesses against the official case is Grace Walden Stevens, who was in the rooming house and saw the man run from the bathroom. Grace Walden Stevens was not allowed to testify at Ray's trial. She was instead put into a mental institution by the FBI because she wouldn't identify Ray from the photos as the person she saw running out of the building. And meanwhile, Charles Quitman Stevens, who was dead drunk at the time and not even conscious, is used as their lead witness. They pay off $2,000 in his bar bills, and then he becomes a lead witness against Ray and claims that he saw Ray run out of the rooming house. Another problem is that Ray runs out with a bundle that includes this rifle that eventually can be traced back to him and that they say is the murder weapon. Not only the FBI not traced the rifle, but Kniep, Jim Kniep from the amusement store where the bundle was dropped, said it was dropped 5 minutes before he heard the shot. So there are, you know, discrepancies there, but Grace Walden Stevens is finally taken out of the mental institution under an arrangement to get her to Jonestown. And I don't know if she's among the Jonestown dead. But there was an attempt by two of the people around Jones to get her a fake passport. And they asked whether they still had the passport of a woman who was murdered, strangely, Maxine Sweeney, up in Ukiah before Jones went to Guyana. So I found connections to the Guyana operation. I found links to other intelligence operations around connected deaths that kept the story from eventually coming out. When an FBI agent who had been part of, a black FBI agent who had been part of searching Ray's car, found pieces of paper that he pocketed at the time because he didn't think that they would survive, which showed handwriting of Ray's with the name Raul, which backed up his story, and a phone number on one of them that was Jack Ruby's phone number in Dallas. Okay, and these came to light eventually, and the FBI discredited them, and they wrote a whole report trying to discredit Dr. Pepper, which he answers in Act of State. So this case, even though it was argued out, and you can see the whole transcript and get the evidence at the King Center site, hardly anyone covered that trial. I think they covered Mrs. King's testimony, but when you got to the testimony of the heart of the case and exonerating James Earl Ray, that wasn't there. And, you know, there were no reporters in the main. In fact, one reporter who insisted on staying was fired by one of the major networks because he was taking down the information. I'll close with a few quotes that I like from Dr. King. This is from a little book, Martin Luther King Jr. Companion, and it's just quotations from his speeches and during his life. Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. The chain reaction of evil, hate begetting hate, wars producing more wars, must be broken, or we shall be plunged into the abyss of annihilation. He also once said that the choice today, and this is even in his time, is not between violence and nonviolence. It's between nonviolence and non-existence. Our scientific power has outrun our spiritual power. We have guided missiles and misguided men. Sooner or later, all the peoples of the world, without regard to the political systems under which they live, will have to discover a way to live together in peace. Man has now reached the day when violence toward another human being must become as abhorrent as eating another's flesh. The oceans of history are made turbulent by the ever-rising tides of hate. History is cluttered with the wreckage of nations and individuals that pursued that self-defeating path of hate. Love is the key to the solution to the problems of the world.
You heard a talk by the acclaimed researcher and lecturer John Judge. He is co-founder of the Coalition on Political Assassinations and was legislative aide to Representative Cynthia McKinney. The release of documents on John F. Kennedy came about because of a huge public demand for openness, triggered by the movie by Oliver Stone. A similar popular movement might bring us open access, not just to the King assassination, but break the stranglehold of secrecy that allows the political class in the U.S. to operate with impunity. John Judge was recorded by Active Ingredients in April 2006 at Smith College in Northampton. Visit TUC Radio's website at www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org for links to more information. Please find a pen to write down a phone number for the information on how to order an audio tape or CD of this one-hour talk. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your CD or tape order is our only support and is essential in keeping us on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD by mail or credit card by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 1-877-882-8273. Time of useful consciousness is an aeronautical term, the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for the pilot to save the plane. My name is Maria Gelaudin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.